another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show, coming to you live from Portland, Oregon. We talk about metaphysical topics, ancient and modern mysteries of the day. We have a very special guest tonight. He's a modern-day archaeologist and Indiana Jones. He's an author and a researcher, produces wonderful DVDs, and we're going to talk about ancient mysteries. Welcome to the show, Jay Widener.
Hey, thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Glad to have you. And I want to start talking, first of all, about the mystery schools of Egypt back in 3000 BC. They certainly knew that the stars were not quite fixed in the sky, that they moved across the sky. Why don't you talk about this time cycle they came up with, known as precession?
Yeah, the ancient Egyptians especially were incredibly adept. And what they did was, they had these schools, and these schools existed for thousands of years, and they kept copious notes. And one of the things that these schools did was they watched plant chemistry, and sometimes they watched tides, and also what they did was they watched the stars at night. And what they noticed over time was that the same stars did not rise in the same place every single of the same nights of the year. So that, say, Sirius rose over a nearby mountaintop on June 21st, you would notice 70 years later that it was now rising 1 degree north. And so they realized that slowly the positions of the stars was changing. And then they watched this cycle long enough, and they realized that if you watched that Sirius rising on June 21st, you would see that it would go all the way across your entire horizon until, calculating forward, of course, they realize that on June 21st, 26,000 years later, it would again rise right over that mountain peak again. And they realize that the whole entire sky was moving in a gigantic circle. And they marked this gigantic circle with the equinoxes, which is, of course, our March 21st, June 21st, September 21st, and the equinoxes and the solstices, and they created what is called the astrological calendar, or the great year, which is the 12 months of the zodiac, each acting at 2,160-year intervals, creating a 26,000-year-long clock that you can see with your own eye if you're lucky enough to live long enough.
So, absolutely.
Yeah, so this became a great secret among the Egyptians, among the Mayans, among the Greeks, many, many people, and only the people that were in their ancient sacred mystery schools knew the secret of the precession of the equinoxes. What they did was they noticed that when these schools went on for a long time, you have to remember, and what they noticed is that when one of the months of the zodiac would change, when it go from Aries to Pisces or wherever, they noticed that there were profound changes here on Earth. And so they created this system, and it was called alchemy. That meant as above, so below. As the stars change, so too do things change here. And because they were especially astute people, they began noticing that there were profound and predictable changes that could happen or would happen here on Earth every time we pass through another sign. Another thing that they noticed was that any time that we pass through one of the four fixed signs of the 12-sign zodiac, the changes on Earth were even more pronounced. So if we went through the sign of Taurus, this would be a huge change here on Earth. Or if we went through the sign of Scorpio, or through the sign of Leo, or through the sign of Aquarius. And they noticed that, and of course there's actually historical linkage to support this whole idea, because 6,500 years ago we went through the age of Taurus, and this was the beginning of the first walled cities in Quetzalhayuk and in Samaria are found.
Change occurred 6,500 years ago with Samaria popping up out of nowhere. Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah, and the great war god Sargon coming out of Mesopotamia and conquering most of the known world, beginning of chronological timekeeping, the 24-hour day, the 7-day week, the written word, slavery, war.
Pyramids, modern societies.
That's right. Everything began at the age of Taurus. We look at 13,000 years ago at the age of Leo, we have a tremendous climatic change on Earth. Some kind of catastrophe happened which broke open the ice ages and stopped the cycle for a long time. Huge extinctions of the woolly mammoths and the giant tree sloths and the
dinosaurs, sure.
Yes, well, not the dinosaurs. They were 65 million years ago. But the saber-toothed tiger, these gigantic mammals suddenly died out. And if you look at 26,000 years ago at the last time we passed through the age of Aquarius, it could be argued that was the emergence of Cro-Magnon man and the final death of Neanderthal. So we see that the precession in the sky seems to dictate events here on Earth and probably vice versa, reinforcing the Hermetic idea, as above, so below. What happens above happens here. Or as I like to say, changes in the light above cause the same changes on the ground below. So this is
what's pretty amazing. I was reading your article today, and you talked about the average length of a human is 72 years. And how many days does that translate out to?
Almost exactly 26,000. This is, of course, 260. The fractal of that is the sacred Mayan number. Their Mayan year was 260. So the Mayan calendar is based on a 260-day year-day cycle. 260 days is exactly the time that it takes for a human being to gestate inside the womb.
It's all related.
26,000 is also the number of years in the precession of the equinox, but it's also the number of light years between us and the center of the galaxy. And so we see there's this huge kind of strange coincidence going on with the number 260, 26,000, and
72, certainly.
It's all part of this overarching matrix, which we can only begin to discern. And
right.
Shadows of it, but we don't really see it. And so the shadows of it are these 26,000-day-long programs or 26,000-year-long programs that are running. And we see that, and occasionally a really smart group of people will crack through the shadows of the arching matrix, and like the Mayan with their calendar, or the person who built the cross of Hende, and they will.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you next, was how did the Mayans and the Aztecs stumble upon the same 25,920-year cycle that the Egyptians did? How did they come upon it?
Same exact way, just watching the sky and then calculating forward.
And what year was that they came upon?
Well, that was about 2,000 years ago is when they developed their calendar. Mm-hmm. So they there's enough evidence, although I don't want to go out on a limb here, there's enough evidence to say that they're both from the same civilization, the Egyptians, the Mayans, and they carried the knowledge forward, and the knowledge was actually known more like 100,000 years ago.
Okay. Now let's jump ahead to 1,600 years to France, to the Cross of Hende. Why don't you go ahead and lead into the Cross of Hende and talk about that?
Yeah, well, the Cross of Hende is, one of the strangest mysteries. I first came across it while reading a strange anonymous book written by an anonymous writer named Fulcanelli. And he wrote a book called Mystery of the Cathedrals, and many people know this story. And he inserted a chapter in the reprinting of his book in the 50s, Mystery of the Cathedrals, or someone inserted a new chapter. And this chapter is called The Cyclic Cross of Hende. That brought my attention to it, trying to figure out why someone would put a new chapter into an ancient book by an anonymous writer. And
sure.
So then I began reading it, and I realized that he probably meant for it to be included in the original, but realized that it was just too hot to put out in 1926, and that he had to put it out right before the last generations of this time period so that he could get the message out to them, for them to be able to do whatever it is they're going to do at the end of time. So this chapter is about this odd monument that sits in a churchyard in a little town on the Spanish border in France called Hende, which is interesting because usually the H is silent at the beginning of words in French, so it means Hende, or it's pronounced Hende. And so it's a little town called Hende, and in Hende is this cross which is predicting the end days. And so you begin looking at this cross, and I did, and I began slowly deciphering it, which is all in the book, Mystery of the Great Cross. And you can get my documentary, Secrets of Alchemy, The Great Cross at the End of Time, and you can see how I did it and everything. But basically the cross is saying that there's the sun is acting up, it's going to begin heating up. Now, this is in the 20s and in the 50s as this book came out, and that the northern hemisphere is going to be destroyed by something that is going on with the sun. So, you know, I got done with this research about 97 and, you know, scratched my head wondering whether any of this was worth, you know, 20 years of my life. And the next summer was 1998. And it was the hottest summer ever recorded.
Sunspots, right?
Something. And, of course, this summer looks like it's going to be the winter of all winters, and as far as heating. And so the Earth is heating up. Fulcanelli was right. The Cross of Hende is right. And each year, the Cross of Hende gains in credibility. And we now know that, you know, there's something going on. Anyone who's not seeing it is just not paying attention. And so then the question becomes, okay, so then if that's true, that means everything else that Fulcanelli is predicting is probably going to come true. And if that is so, then, you know, we're in for a rather interesting time over the next 15, 20 years.
Absolutely. Why don't you talk about the four Hindi ages, the gold, silver, bronze, and iron age talked about on the cross?
Yeah, well, on the cross there's a oval blocked up into four quadrants, and each quadrant has a strange A in it, which looks like a Freemasonic A. And so I went into my alchemical lore, read a lot of books on alchemy, and tried to figure out, you know, what this all meant. And it comes down to the fact that the whole point of alchemy is to turn lead into gold. And so you find out that there's four ages in alchemy. There's a gold age, then there's a silver age, and there's the bronze age, and then there's an iron age. And Fulcanelli clearly states that, you know, we're living in the iron age. This is the worst it can get right now. And that each of the other ages is much better, the golden age being an age of complete perfection. Excuse me. So I began looking into this, and I realized that one of the points of alchemy, one of the things that alchemists are supposed to be doing, is performing the great alchemical experiment at the end of time, which transmutes the Iron Age into the Golden Age, and that all real, true, practicing alchemists, you know, need to be working towards this, especially at this moment in time, especially with Fulcanelli's warning in the chapter on the Cross of Hende. So this is the great promise of alchemy, is that at the depths of the worst of the Iron Age, suddenly you can transfuse it, and in an instant it becomes the iron, or the golden age.
Golden age, okay.
Yeah, a golden age. And this is what is predicted by the Mayans, and this is what is predicted by the Tibetans to happen and occur in 2012, which is why, you know, we made the movie 2012, The Odyssey, this big hit movie that's out, because we want to the movie itself to participate in this alchemical process of transmuting the Iron Age into the Golden Age. And this will happen only by sheer will, only by us willing that we want this world, this age, to come to a final. And we want another age that's more filled with equality and justice and good food and right living, you know, to emerge out of this. And I think that's what's going on. I think you're seeing the age of materialism is going away. It's shedding. We're like going through the death throes of it with the war in Iraq. And we're at the end of this. You know, we're going to realize, you know, what's really important is, you know, you and I and our friends and our family and a nice fire at night and some good food and sitting around and telling stories and dancing and playing music. And this is what's important in life and not this other stuff. And
so you don't see a catastrophe or a pole shift happening. You see an enlightenment happening.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Happening.
I do. I think that that's what will precede the enlightenment. I think there's going to be a series of catastrophes, and they will be like cleansings, and they will, you know, they will...
We will reincarnate, right.
No, we won't reincarnate. We'll be in these bodies. We will be refined by the process. Just like the fires of alchemy refine lead into gold, so shall the fires of what is about to happen to us refine us and turn us into something better. You'll be better for the catastrophe. I know it's hard to believe.
Well, I keep getting different takes on this material. Now, on the date of the winter solstice, December 21st, 2012, isn't it true that all of the planets are going to align on the far side of the sun?
No, that's not true at all.
No? Is there going to be some kind of alignment on that day?
It's the center of the galaxy is aligning with the sun. So when the sun rises on the solstice that morning, it's going to rise with the center of the galaxy, which is the single most important spot in our cosmic neighborhood. And when this happens, this is a, you know, great moment foretold by all of the great traditions. This is what they've been waiting for. Now, is it the actual event of the center of the galaxy aligning with the sun and the earth on that moment? Is that the great moment? It may be, but most likely it's just like the hands lining up at 12 on your clock. It's not the clock that's important. Uh-huh. It's that, hey, it's, you know, midnight, or hey, it's noon, right? And and just like noon is different from midnight, so too shall this time be different from that time. And so that's what it really is, just a big clock. So the center of the galaxy, the precession of the equinoxes, you know, yes, they may be measuring other incredible cosmic things, but they're also and mostly just a giant clock to tell you what time it is. And the time is the time now of the great change. And that just happens when the alignment happens.
Right, and moving into this age of Aquarius, tell everybody where they can get your DVD. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, you can get it at sacredmysteries.com, www.sacredmysteries.com. It's 2012, The Odyssey. There's Secrets of Alchemy. There's Quantum Astrology, Healing the Luminous Body, Healing Sounds, Alchemical Healing, Yoga of Light, Art Mind. There's so many, it's not even funny. It says Ancient Sacred Mystery School on DVD, allowing everyone free access, well, not free, but at least access to the great mysteries by the best teachers that we can bring forward that are alive today. And that's what's going on, and it's like a great time. This, you know, no other time in history has this kind of information been allowed or available. And here we are, and it's just there. And it's a great time. It's a great time of optimism. You know, there's a lot of bad things going on, but, you know, there's also a lot of really good things going on, and those get overlooked most of the time in our busy lives.
Yeah, the veil is lifting. So let's move over to Peru now, and tell me about the shamans that are coming down from the mountains and giving us a message. What are they talking about?
Well, I just got back from Peru last week. We were there again filming the sequel to 2012, The Odyssey, and we were shooting the Caro shaman up in the mountains around Cusco, and well, there, what the Incan have is an ancient prophecy that that at a certain point a great magical sorcerer of their people will return, and his name was Pachacuti, and Pachacuti is due to return, well, has returned in the early 90s, and is living somewhere up high in the Andes Mountains. And he's transmuting the Caro and the people visiting Peru who go up there and attend certain light body schools. He's transmuting people into light.
Wow.
And, and this is the beginning of a new species called Homo luminis, which is going to repopulate the planet. And it's actually happening to people within their own bodies. That's why it's not a reincarnation thing. It can happen to you or me or, you know, anyone. And so this is a real thing. It's the secret of alchemy. The prophecies say that all of the secrets of alchemy will be released right before the end of time. Well, it's 5.5 years till the end of time. And, in fact, the secrets of alchemy are being released. And pretty soon this will be just blasé knowledge to everyone. Oh, yeah, yeah, he went down to Peru and became a light body. Oh, yeah, it'll be like, oh. And this is going to become real, and it's bypassing everybody in the celebrity culture, all of the people in politics who know nothing about what's really going on and what's really important, and it's truly revolutionary, beyond any doubt.
Well, how can a person become a light worker in Peru? Is there an invitation, or can you just go down there and seek it out?
Well, there's schools. There's Alberto Viodo has a school called The Four Winds at thefourwinds.com, which is a really good school about how the light body is activated, he helps thousands of people every year not just solve their own problems, but also repair the damage of past lives and faulty imprints. And then he takes them down to Peru at the end, and they go through the whole light body school down there. It's quite a profound trip. There's Dr. Juan del Prado, who is also doing a lot of work out of Cusco with the light body tradition. And so it's going on. There's a lot going on. If someone really wants to know, they can go to my website at jwidener.com and contact me, and I'll help them out in some way.
I think people in our audience would love that. Now let's talk about the whole Christian movement, and they're gearing up toward the end of times and a golden millennium. How does that dovetail with your research?
Well, the Christians have the same prophecies that everybody else does, because there is this ancient tradition that goes back way, way back, all the way to Egypt. Unfortunately, the fundamentalists, and I don't mean to offend any of them out there, they haven't read the sources. They don't quite understand what it is they're reading, and when they finally do have an understanding, it's usually a xenophobic understanding that somehow is telling them that only they are the ones who get to get through, which is, you know, not only putting in, to my point of view, incredible judgments on God's shoulders, choosing who goes and who doesn't, but what joy would there be anyway to be raptured and look down and see your
misery.
Many
yeah.
fallen brothers and sisters in abject misery, yes. And so it becomes quite problematic because it's either a completely immoral system, which that would be, or there's something missing. And in fact, there's something missing. And what's missing is the love. What is missing is overarching love for all people and compassion for all people and the desire to help people. You know, I don't have to do this. I could go back to my business and make a lot of money, and I don't have to go on the air and tell people that the end of time is at hand. I'm not making a lot of money at that. But, you know, I owe it. I mean, I learned this. I learned this knowledge. A lot of gates were opened up for me. A lot of books dropped in my hands by angels, and I realized, you know, I owe something back. And so you got to give something back to the world, and the world, those few people who actually are going to listen and are going to do something, you know, that's all that counts. And so the Christians have to realize that, you know.
You get away from the fear-based religion, right?
Yeah, and then Muslims and Jews and everybody else are their brothers, too. And everybody else has to realize that, too. So the Christians are right. You know, Jesus or the imminent return of something in that form could be at hand.
What's interesting, in the book of Revelation, you talk about the four symbols being the same.
That's definitely right. In fact, well, I don't know how far to go.
The eagle and... Right.
It's turning out now that the Book of Revelation is actually a copy of a book that was written about 500 B.C. called The Revelation of Isis and Osiris, which was a prophetic text, a prophetic alchemy text. And when you understand that, then all of a sudden the Book of Revelation and its startling prophecies become much more understandable and much more easily understood. And the Cross of Hendaye is based somewhat on these same revelations. And at the end of time, at the end of every age, there's always a war. And there's always great conflict as these forces fight it out at the very end of time. And the ending is always known, but for some reason the forces of evil still have to whack it out with it.
So, they have to try.
They did, yeah. For some reason. And this is like so ancient and well-worn that it's in so many different cultures that, you know, it's not a big surprise. So this is what's going on now, and we're now reaching the end game of our entire civilization. It will be over in 5.5 years, I guarantee it. There's not going to be any oil. There will be oil, but it'll be $25-$30 a gallon. It'll cost $500 to fill your tank. A loaf of bread is going to be $20. A gallon of milk is going to be $30. There's going to be no food.
So we're on a runaway train here with the population going beyond 6 billion and just exploding and running out of resources.
It's not just the population, it's also when the Bush boys got into office in 2000, they're all oil guys, and they knew that there had been vast overpumping of the oil reserves in the 1990s, and they knew that Saddam and they knew that Iran were the two biggest violators of this. And so the first thing they did when they got, after they contrived their way into Iraq, the first thing they did was check how much oil was really left in the wells there.
Sure.
And it was even less than they thought. So we're headed toward, and they need to get to Iran now to find out how much is in Iran's oil wells so they really know how much is left. But the rough estimates are that there's not, and they're not doing anything to replace it. There's no hydrogen plants going in. There's no nuclear power plants going in. They're not spending one dime to create any sort of alternative infrastructure. And so anybody with a dime's breadth of foresight can see that in 5.5 years, we're all going to be in complete and abject poverty. And I mean, even the wealthy of us, probably. So, and nobody's doing anything much about it. And
so we need to will this golden age into existence.
Well, this will be the golden age, you see, because once we move in and learn how to adjust our lives to this age beyond oil, and where we can conserve things a little more and grow food a little closer to our homes and take care of our families a little better than we've been doing, we're going to find that, you know what, it's all right here. There was nowhere to go to begin with. And I think that's what's going on. And I think we're going to find that it's going to be a better world for artists and musicians, and big, huge entertainments are going to go away. And
it'll be community-based, right?
It will be completely community-based. It's
exactly a renaissance society, yeah.
Yeah, we'll still have our computers and our internets and things, but we're not going to be racing around the planet, traveling, and those days will all be over. It'll cost $35,000 to go to Europe, you know, and those days will be over. And there's no way around this one. They can try what they want, but, you know, people were probably saying right now, oh, yeah, well, he's just buying the line that there's no new oil discoveries, but there are. You're right, you people who think that there are a whole bunch of oil discoveries out there and that in the Caspian Sea, et cetera. But guess what? They're not going to get it out of it. They've decided to leave it in the ground. That's why you don't see anything happening. They decided to leave it in the ground and wait until after the catastrophe. And so the catastrophe is coming. Get some food. Learn how to grow some food. Get some firewood. Take care of your families. You know, that's all I can
say. Why is this group of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergs, all these secret societies, why are they pushing for a one-world government then, this new world order?
To make sure that there's no, to be able to set up the security apparatus to watch for all insurrections. That a group out in the middle of, say, Wisconsin doesn't start an insurrection. And they have political control over them, even though they're thousands and thousands of miles away. And so that's why. It's to create worldwide national security apparatus to prevent all insurrections and to stay on top of all insurrections, and then therefore it'll be this world that they want.
Okay, well, I guess that leads us into the Denver airport. It's a very mysterious place. Billions were spent on it with levels underground. Why don't you talk about the Denver airport and why it perhaps was built?
Yeah, well, I think the Denver airport was built because of a thing called continuity of government, which came in the 80s, and they decided to build a centralized airport in the United States in Denver that could help government survive a catastrophe in some way. And so they built this airport, and they put underground trains going into the Rocky Mountains and other places to ferry very important people into safe places in case of a catastrophe. And that's really the whole point of it. And
well, they left some clues behind on the murals and the paintings on the walls, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, they left truth behind and all over the airport. They left their fingerprints everywhere. They're very proud.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, there's these four murals that are found in two different spots in the airport, and these murals have little stories. They're very well done. They're done by a Mayan artist named Leo Taguma. And one is the entire theme of this mural is extinction. The entire mural is filled with the white whale and the dodo bird and the quetzal and all the animals that have gone extinct. And included are three people. One is a Native American who's in a coffin. One is a little white girl who's in a coffin. And the other is a black boy who's in a coffin. And then there's another mural where they're beating their swords into plowshares, all the children of the world. There's another mural where all the children of the world are worshiping this gigantic psychedelic plant, which is blossoming in the middle of them, and is quite spectacular. And then the other mural is a Nazi stormtrooper marching down the street with a gas mask on, and he's piercing the Dove of Peace with his sword. And I have no
idea. That spells it out.
Yeah. I have no idea.
They're talking about a coming catastrophe, right?
Yeah.
Now, wasn't there also a Freemasonic capstone in the airport as well?
Yeah, on the south side of the airport, and unless they've taken it down since our movie came out, is a capstone dedicated with the airport dedication to the men who helped build the airport, including Mayor Federico Pena of Denver, who later became the Secretary of Transportation under Clinton, and all these people with the big, huge Freemasonic insignia. And so we can see that the Denver airport is really a cathedral to the New World Order. And if you go there, you'll see so much more than just what I told you. You won't even believe it. And quite an amazing place. If you ever have to do a stop through, it's well worth getting out, going into the main airport, and checking everything out.
Really. Absolutely. Now, wasn't one of the engineers a kind of a mysterious, legendary guy named Phil Schneider? Didn't he work on it and find some strange discoveries, and then he died soon afterwards?
Actually, I don't think Phil Schneider worked on the Denver airport. He died in 96, I think, or just about the time the Denver airport was opening up.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a strange guy. He lived in New Mexico, and at the time he was assigned to the Dulce base there, and he claims that they were flushing out gigantic ancient tunnel systems that were built by aliens thousands of years ago, and that there were like aliens that were still in these tunnel systems, and they would get in firefights with them and flush them out. And he got wounded, and he did a press conference of this in 96, showed the wounds, the scars of his wounds and everything, and then he was murdered a couple weeks later, and it sent quite a chill through everybody. But generally, this kind of work is not, first off, is never hardly ever talked about in any of the radio shows or things that go on. People don't really know anything about this kind of secret tunnel system that runs around the Earth, but it also apparently is something that people in power really don't like to have talked about, because it's something there that terrifies them. I haven't quite figured out what it is. The Hopi say that there's this tunnel system, and that these creatures called the Ant People live in the tunnel system, and that one of the things the ancient Hopis had to do was at night they would hang out near the openings of these cave and tunnel systems and then ambush the Ant People and kill them. And I was just in Peru, went to several of the tunnel system openings that are in the Andes, and a lot of them are locked up by the government now, or concreted over, or have armed guards in front of them. But there's still a few that are available. And, you know, the locals there, too, also say that there's something that lives, you know, inside the tunnel systems, and you better not mess with it. So, you know, it's one of these strange things that's in the occult lore. Nobody really ever talks about it, and yet there's so much literature on it that after a while you can, like, scratch your head and say, well, there must be something here. There's just too much smoke. You know, so.
Right, but what about in India, where they have these 30 steps that lead underground to these doors, and there's serpent people or Nagas underground? Are you familiar with this legend?
Yes, that's one of the great Indian legends, and also there's a book, Man and Mystery in Tibet, which was written in the 20s, in which the writer, who's a Russian, goes to Tibet and actually goes down into the underground world and meets a terrible being that calls itself the King of the World, and the King of the World declares that at the end of time he's going to come out from underground and rule the world. And this is a nonfiction book, and quite sober in most of its narrative. And then all of a sudden, you know, this jolting thing near the end, like, huh? You know, did he really just say that? You know,
and, it's a shocker, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's other ones. You know, there's another one, a great book called The Tunnels of Encora, which is about a journalist in Brazil who goes into the Eastern Andes with an Indian, a white Indian, and there's all these tunnel systems, and the Nazis had found them and were hiding in them, and the Nazis were obsessed with this tunnel system and were always looking for it.
I think it's called The Chronicles of Akakor. It's very obscure, but I have heard of that too as well.
Yeah, yeah. There's a very little about it unless you get into the ancient texts. There's very little about it in modern books. There's a few books written about this, most of them not very good. But if you get into ancient alchemical texts or ancient books that were famous 300 years ago, this is like one of the main subjects of the writings. There's a whole book by Antonius Kircher called Mundus Subterraneus, or The Subterranean World, which is all about all of this and matter-of-factly speaking about it. So it's really a fascinating subject, you know.
Right. I want to bring you back to Egypt because you have a great article on your website, and it talks about how we think of the word soul and spirit as the same kind of word, but back in Egypt they knew a lot about the underworld. Why don't you talk about the Ka and the Ba?
Yeah, the ancients believed that the human being was really five different bodies, and two of those bodies were called the Ka and the Ba. So these become the basis for our words for soul and spirit, and show once and for all that soul and spirit are not the same thing. So your ka is your, you might say, your residual spirit, and your ba is your everlasting aspect. And what that means is that everything that you come into contact with in this life, you know, you leave a little bit of you behind, whether you actually really do, in the form of DNA. So you touch, you know, your keys, and you leave a little bit of your DNA on the keys. You know, you leave it with your girlfriend, you know, all over the place. And when you die, this ka, this residual, continues to live. So a psychic can take your keys, rub them, and go, oh, you know, this is blah, blah. He lives here. He's got, you know, a car like this,
uh-huh,
and a girlfriend that looks like this. And you know, she can see your whole life through the residual of this spirit that lives through your objects and things. And this is what ghosts are. They're attached to places. This is where they live. This is the residual spirit of the person left behind.
And they replay a drama over and over, right? Like
over,
maybe they were murdered or something in some hotel or whatever, and they replay
right,
it over
like
and over.
The ghost is a guy in the subway in the movie Ghost who pushes him off the subway over and over. The guy's just pushing people off the subway. Well, so this is one aspect, and then the other aspect is this this everlasting, immortal thing that goes back and reincarnates and moves to other worlds and advances evolutionarily through different domains. And this is what we call our soul, or what they call the Ba. So in Egypt, they realized that what you didn't want to do was leave your residual behind like that. That not only was it nightmarish for the poor residual spirit, the ka, to be left behind like that, but it was a sign that you had not died properly. And so at death, they did everything they could to bind the ka and the ba. And this is where, like, the ka, ba,
mummification.
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 It was a degenerative form of this attempt, but it was a form of it. But mostly it was alchemy. It was an attempt through your life to, number one, not leave your ka spread all over the place. That was very important. So the amount of possessions that you had was kept to a minimum so that, you know, there's an old line that everything you own becomes part of your soul. Well, it does. And so they didn't want to have a lot of weight. And this is what is meant by the Egyptian, when you're weighed, when you die, if your soul is heavier than the feather, then you have to reincarnate. If your soul is lighter than the feather, then you get to move on to the next phase. And this is what this means. If you've got thousands and thousands of possessions, then you're going to have a heavy soul. And so the Egyptians, even the wealthy Egyptians, tried to keep their, they live their life knowing that the whole point of this life is to make sure there's a successful marriage of the ka and the ba at the end of life, so that the ba can carry forth the residual. And by doing that, you achieve a higher sense of immortality, because you're taking along your true essence into the afterlife, or the duat, as Egyptians called it. So it's a form of alchemy. It's a very important thing. We've lost it, and now our lands, our countries, are filled with desperate ka spirits who are haunting the landscape and making life very miserable for everybody.
Sure, and graveyards and Indian burial
everywhere.
Sites.
They're everywhere now. There's so many of them, you know, that they're not just in graveyards. They're everywhere. And they don't know where to go. They've never been. They're so cut off from what is real and what isn't that they've never even been taught how to go home. And so eventually, you know, they will go home, but it could take a long time. And
so that's why when you play with a Ouija board, you get all kinds of crazy, confused spirits.
That's right. Never play with a Ouija board. That's it. Big mistake, because you're going to get the most aggressive spirits.
Mm-hmm, sure,
and
sure.
None of them are any good, because if they're still hanging out, these are failures. Right?
They didn't enlighten and move on.
That's right.
Now,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Well, there's this movie called When Dreams May Come. Why don't you talk about how people can create their own heaven or create their own hell and then end up there actually after they die?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. You actually do that. You create your own heaven, you create your own hell, and that's where you go. And we seem to be having the people that are in power over the human race seem to have it in mind that they should be creating only fantastic images of our own hell. So the horror movies and everything that's going on are actually us painting collective pictures of our own demise and what it's going to look like, and it's not going to be a very pretty place. And, you know, so this is another problem at the end of time, is artists really need to be creating, you know, the positive views of what's about to happen, not the negative views. And
right, so we don't manifest that.
We are manifesting it, yes, exactly. And so this is where we're headed, and it's not going to be a sweet thing to watch. At the same time, you know what, it's all good, and we all need to have a great deal of compassion and help each other.
Absolutely. And we're winding down here. We have 5 minutes. I'm going to ask you to give me your 1 minute take on each subject, okay? Back to Peru, the lines and symbols of Nazca embedded in the desert. What's your take on that?
That these are the symbols of the afterlife and the great alchemical tradition that existed down there, still exists, and they're like calling cards telling you to come there and to learn the light body tradition, the way of the hummingbird, the way of the squirrel, the way of the monkey, and that's what I think.
Who made them? The Anunnaki, or...?
No, they're not the Anunnaki, although I don't know who they were. The very first people to to, according to the legends, the Viracocha emerged out of his cave in Lake Titicaca 13,000 years ago, and he decided to bring forth the fruits of the ancient civilization to us, and so they began building everything that happened after that, the lines, even the pyramids. So.
Now, there's two ancient cities at the top of Lake Titicaca, Pumapunku and Tiwanaku. Is that what he built, these cities of the gods at that time?
No, they were there before the last catastrophe. He didn't build them. Well, he may have built them before the last catastrophe, but no, they were built 15 to 20,000 years ago at least.
So they survived the Great Flood?
Yes.
Ah, amazing, because it was so high up then, huh?
That's right.
Okay. Okay, explain what the ley lines are, these mystical lines all around the planet.
These lines are they're like the line, they're like highways for the Ka spirit to be able to navigate the earth and know where to go. And so people would, in the old days, not only would they they build these things, but they would place their dead shaman and kings on graves that were on these ley lines, and these ley lines are permeated high energy lines that direct spirit towards its own becoming. So they're some kind of network that we can't really discern. And because we've lost our way, there's probably not many spirits left using ley lines. At least that's what I hear from my ley line expert friends.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the purpose of them. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Two more real briefly. Nibiru, do you believe there's a 10th planet cycling around our solar system about to come by?
I highly doubt it. I think they're... probably is a 10th planet. There's probably an 11th planet and a 12th planet out there. I think that the gravitational pulsations of the outer planets show this. So I think there's something out there as for it racing through the solar system every few hundred or thousand years. I don't think so, but I could be wrong. I mean, you know, it could happen. And
right. Zachary Sitchin's theory, yeah, that it's coming
right.
around.
Well, I don't know.
And the last question is, Stanley Kubrick was a very learned metaphysical director. Talk about his movie, Space Odyssey.
How do I describe the greatest film ever made?
What did it mean?
Well, Stanley Kubrick, if you want to read it, you have to go to my article, Alchemical Kubrick, 2001, The Great Work on Film at jwidener.com, because that can only do it justice. But basically, Stanley Kubrick was an alchemist, and he made the greatest work of artistic alchemy in the history of the modern world with 2001, A Space Odyssey. The film is a work of alchemy, and in just like alchemy, it's made to transform the viewer, and it does. And so Stanley, I prove beyond any shadow of a doubt, did this all on purpose, and we now know that he was definitely into these subject matters, and it is, beyond any doubt, the greatest film ever made.
Well, one final note is when he was making his final film called Eyes Wide Shut, it was about secret societies, and he died during the final edit of that film.
Actually, he died right about 5 hours after he showed the executives at the film company his cut.
Right, yeah. Pretty interesting.
He went home and died.
Yep. Well, Jay, pardon me, go ahead.
And they won't release his
final cut
version.
Exactly. Yeah, but he was talking about secret societies, definitely. So, Jay, you were a fantastic guest, wonderful. Give us the Sacred Mysteries site one more time, and how can we get a hold of you and your DVDs?
Yeah, it's www.sacredmysteries.com, SacredMysteries.com, sacredmysteries.com, or you can go to my own site, jaywidener.com, jaywiedner.com, and you can contact me, read my articles, see our see some previews of the DVDs and all sorts of good stuff.
Oh, thank you so much, Jay. Take care.
Okay.
Good night.
Thank you.
Okay, just a few minutes left. That was a wonderful interview, and please check out his site and his DVD. And we covered quite a bit of ground. It will be in the archives, so you can replay it because it's a lot of information that we went through. Go to Odyssey from the main webpage, click on Archives, and that will be up soon. So once again, my name is Mike Schultz. I have two DVDs on Ancient Mysteries and the Ancient Astronaut Theory, which was kind of originally brought forth by Eric von Däniken in the film Chariots of the Gods and his book. So I've really updated it for today. So please go to fountainsofyouth.net or just click on Odyssey from the main site and check out my first DVD, The Sands of Time, or my second one, The Temples of Stone. And we certainly get into all this material, and I have many, many, many pictures and photographs. So last thing I want to mention, we didn't get to our news of the day today, but if you go on the main webpage at bbsradio.com, they have a really great news source. They really, if you pull up their news page, news reports, you can just get all the cutting-edge latest information of the day. And the corporate media is so filtered. All of the main networks, they filter out so much information. So go and find these articles from Alex Jones and Jeff Renz and David Icke and all of these cutting-edge researchers. All of the articles are on news reports at the main site. So thanks for joining me today. I'm your host, Mike Schultz, and I will see you on Odyssey again next week. Take care. Good night.